Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
With enough imagination, we can picture bad things that might realistically happen. With enough information, we might accurately predict and prevent bad things from happening. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Now that we have arrived in the era of big data, the challenge is to figure out what facts to collect, what they mean, and how we can use them to make life better for ourselves. And we may need to wrestle with questions about privacy and free will along the way. Filmmaker Sandy Smolin joins us to talk about this new world of information. He directed the documentary The Human Face of Big Data. You can see it tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA TV. Sandy, welcome to Think.
Good morning.
The film starts with a reminder of how much data we are exposed to now, how much we're collecting. Our ancestors would find it literally mind-boggling.
It's so true. Just the amount of data being generated by all of our devices, our phones, our computers, our cars, the wearable devices, there's more data being collected in one day than used to be collected in someone's entire lifetime.
Besides the information that we're aware of, that we give up online, you know, we have to sign up for things, where else is all this information about us being generated?
Basically, every digital device now is putting off data, every medical device. Certainly our computers, our phones, our iPads, our tracking devices, our Fitbits. I think none of us are really aware of just how much data is being generated all the time by everything around us. Our cars, you really can't think of almost any digital device now that isn't putting up data.
And of course, it can be combined in new ways to spot patterns and trends. Can you help us understand why the huge volume of data is more useful than the things that we can observe at a human scale or can be more useful?
Oh, that's the really great and wonderful part of the story, is that there's this entire invisible world that we never could see before when you start looking at the data. And Jay Walker, who runs TEDMED, talks about the fact that it's almost the equivalent, as important as the discovery of the microscope, that there is this whole world that was unseen before. But if you start to look through the data, pour through the data, there's a lot of stories there. And it's almost like the unraveling of mysteries that could not be unraveled without all that information. For example, a medical study that used to have 200 people for 2 years now has 2 million people in real time. And that's an immense amount of information that is being poured through, but the insights coming through that. There's a great story in the movie about a doctor in a neonatal ward who came to the ward and realized that there was data being written down once an hour for each baby there, but all the other data that was being collected was just spinning out of memory. And she said, let's take a look at the data. Let's see what's happening there. Let's see what we can discover. And what she found was, by looking at the data, there were patterns that you couldn't see with the visible eye that would be a good prediction of infections before they were visible to the nurses. And that was all there in the data.
So, for example, hours before a baby spiked a fever, there might be a fluctuation in pulse rate or something like that. That wasn't enough to cause alarm if you were just sort of checking.
Right. No sign of it at all. Hmm. But you could tell from those fluctuations that there was a story there in the data. So the data keeps – one of the things we kept finding was that there were all these stories if you look deeper into the data and into the data stories. There's another one that I love. Deb Roy, who was a researcher at MIT, was curious to see how language was formed. And he had a newborn baby, and he put a camera in every room of his house for a year and collected about 400 gigabytes of data every day. And then went through with his research team and started looking at that data. And what they discovered was that it wasn't repetition, but it was context. Where a word was used in different, when a word was used in different contexts, it was more likely to be learned faster. And that was only visible by looking through the data.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I guess experts in childhood language development had assumed that the repetition was the reason that babies learn certain words faster than others. And then all this data, which probably made Deb Roy very unpopular on social media, but revealed something that literally nobody could have predicted.
Yep. And those were the stories that we kept coming across over and over again. And, you know, I think initially, when people heard the word big data, and when we started this project, it really wasn't a widely known word. But the first instinct was big data, was Big Brother, and it was the government spying on us. And we realized that there was a bigger story that wasn't being told, which was how all this data, when analyzed properly, could really be a tool that would help us as a society and as a culture move through an increasingly complex world. And we've gotten to the point now where there's only so much we can do with our brains without the computers being an extension of our ability to know the world. But now we're able to know the world in much more deeper, complex ways.
I love the fact in the film that the first game-changing data set in human history was astronomical observations.
That's right. And you know, we have been collecting data for a long time, but on a much smaller scale. In the last 50 years, certainly, but certainly in the last 10, 15 years, that pace has just sped up greater and greater and greater. And in a way, the internet needed to be into place first for all this data to be collected and analyzed. And that was sort of the skin that came into place. But now that that's in place and all the data now can start to flow and track and be aggregated, and now people can start to look at that data and pour through it, and that's what data scientists do.
What I like thinking about are all the data points that are currently, you know, assumed to be useless that might have value later. Years ago, I worked on a documentary, and the footage that we actually based our story on was stuff that had been left out by news broadcasts because it was sort of behind the scenes. The cameras just happened to be rolling. And yet, when we were trying to tell a different story, those became really important, and we were glad that they had been preserved. There are probably a lot of things that we think don't matter to anybody that might.
And also just old, what we considered really old data sets that don't seem important now. Like they are now going back through all the old mariner logs back in the 1700s, 1800s. Every ship kept a log of weather, sea conditions, and they're actually now taking all those logs and making them digital and realizing that that data, that weather data, was collected a long time ago, and that data now can be used. And applied to data and looking at what's happening now. So, one of the things that data scientists love to do is take different sets of data sets that don't necessarily match and see what they can find in looking at it in unusual ways.
Of course, one big challenge is getting the algorithms right, the math and the formulas for interpreting all this. Big data, as the film points out, is not knowledge until it's been processed.
That's right. You know, Yeah, the data itself is raw, and the data itself is neutral. It's one, how we choose to look at it, what we look for, how we figure out, you know, what are the questions that we want the data to answer, and then also making sure that the data is good data. But you know, in the field of medicine, that's where one of the places where you really see the impact of data, and you know, it used to be that. When Stephen Jobs years ago wanted to get his DNA sequence, it cost $100,000. Now that same sequencing is going to cost $300. And there's going to be a big change in how we prescribe medicine. Because right now, most of the time, you fit within a category. I think I read a statistic that 60% of people that take Lipitor, it actually doesn't work, but they kind of fit that basic category. But in a very short period of time, you'll go into a doctor and they'll look at your DNA and they'll give you a prescription for something that matches exactly your DNA and what works for your body. And we're going to look back in a short period of time and look back at what we do now and think it's really, really basic and almost barbaric that we're not looking at the individual and the individual's DNA. And that information just wasn't available before. But that's a data story.
Lots of people are familiar with the amazing tale of Google's success, accidental at first, at tracking flu outbreaks faster and more accurately than the CDC. How did they do it?
So one of the things they did was they started looking at searches and the search terms that people were using. And so during normally for the CDC to tell if there's a flu epidemic, they have to wait about 2 weeks for the doctors to file the reports and for those reports to make their way to the CDC. And then they can tell there's a flu epidemic. Well, some of the researchers at Google realized that if you could just look at the searches, the number of people that were searching flu terms or flu remedies, you could possibly predict the flu epidemic in real time. And when they started to build the algorithm for it, they found that they could actually predict it faster and more accurately than the CDC. And that was remarkable that basically we kind of forget that we're all not only taking things off the internet and but we're also contributing to the internet. So every time you do a search, you're not just pulling something off. You're actually putting something back in. Your search is an indicator of something that is happening within the greater, larger society. So Google flu trends became, they realized that they could actually predict the flu much faster than anybody else.
But there's an interesting asterisk on the end of that story because if a flu outbreak generates enough media attention, people start Googling search terms even when they're not sick.
And it did that. It did that the second year after they came up with their algorithm. But then by the third year, they figured out how to take that into account. And so now they've gotten the model working again. And you know, we're in the sort of kindergarten stage of all this in a way. So there's still a lot of learning curves. But the processing is happening faster, and the information that we're getting out of it is happening quicker and faster and more accurately.
I Google a lot of weird things because of the wide variety of topics that we cover on the show. I mean, I don't know what somebody would think about who I am if they didn't know anything about me. But I've wondered about the extent to which our search histories could be read almost like a view into our thoughts.
Absolutely. There is a company in Boston that can actually tell if you're depressed by looking at your normal pattern, because we all have a very normal pattern of behavior. And if that behavior changes, and this is really important for diabetics who often, if they get depressed, they don't take their medicine. But this system, this program, can actually tell if someone's depressed just because that pattern, that normal pattern that we all have, starts to change. So the tweets go down, the emails go down, the searches go down, and that becomes an indicator. And the system can actually tell the provider or family member that something's happening. So yes, our searches are an incredibly revealing window into who we are. And there's a lot you can tell about people just by what they search for. You can tell if people are having an affair by what they buy. You can tell amazing things, and you know, a variety of things about people's habits by what they look for, what they shop, who they talk to. There's a very, very detailed portrait of ourselves being gathered by every time we use our devices.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, though, because I don't know about you, Sandy, but I find it fascinating to imagine learning something about someone else based on all those patterns. But the idea that someone's looking at what I'm doing, it makes me uncomfortable.
And that is the flip side. You know, the film really wanted to look at in a very balanced way, how all this data that's being generated is being used. And, you know, and I think most, you know, most of what we found, a lot of what we found, was really positive. But you can't tell the story without talking about the flip side and the dark side. And we have lost privacy as we've known it. And I think we're stepping into a world where we have to rethink our notions of privacy. Because if we choose to use our devices, if we want the convenience of one-click shopping and searches and Facebook, we give up something for that. There's a wonderful quote in the movie by Jared Thorpe, who was a data artist at the New York Times, that everyone thinks that Facebook is free. Facebook is not free. There's a transaction going on. And in return for the ease and the service, everything about you that you share is being used by Facebook to sell ads and to make quite a bit of money from it. But most people are willing to do that, to make that deal, to make that trade, to give up that data in return for the convenience. And our hope in the film is that to begin a public conversation about data rights and data use and whose data is this. There's a...
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is filmmaker Sandy Smolin. His new documentary, The Human Face of Big Data, airs tonight at 9 on KERA-TV. You can join us at 800-933-5372, and we'll return in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with filmmaker Sandy Smolin, who directed the documentary The Human Face of Big Data. You can see it tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA television. If you'd like to join our conversation here on KERA radio, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or maybe you're listening online and want to email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Sandy, before we had to take a break, you were saying there is no question that there is a transaction taking place. We are giving data in order to receive services like, easy online shopping and Facebook and that sort of thing.
10 years ago, if someone said, we want you to take a device that's going to tell us where you are, what you buy, who you talk to, where you go, would you carry that device?
Of course
not. I think everyone would say absolutely not. And yet we now stand in line and pay $800 for that privilege. But we don't think about it that way, do we? There's another story which is sort of connected to this, which is there's a man named Hugo Campos who had a pacemaker, and he went to Medtronic and said, I'd like to get my data. He has a Fitbit, and he likes kind of wanted to keep an idea on his health and his heart. And they said, well, I'm sorry, that's our data. It's our device that's our data. He said, well, wait, that's my heart. My heart's putting out that data. I'd like to get access to it. And they said, I'm sorry, this is ours. And he spent 2 years and finally got them to give permission on a one-time basis for him alone to get access to his data. So it raises the question, whose data is it?
Why would anybody be denying access to personal data to the people who generated it?
I don't know. That's a really good question. Because, you know what? Actually, I do know the answer to that. Because that data is worth something. There are millions of dollars being made every day trading the data that comes off your, every time you do a search and suddenly you get those ads because you search for something. Someone's taken that search, they've traded that data to an advertiser, and there's a transaction going on, and Facebook is as big as it is in part because they sell all that data. So that data is worth a lot. It's worth a lot to everybody, but to those of us who generate it. And I think that there is, increasingly a growing debate that hopefully will happen about whose data is it and what's it worth and should we give it away so freely?
I want to talk a little bit more about medical monitoring because it really is astonishing, especially over large populations, the things that can be suggested by, data points and behaviors and trends. Do you think is there any question that we will be more and more wired as time goes on and pumping more data somewhere for use by our doctors or our insurance companies or someone else?
Absolutely, we will. And I think most of it will be good for the good. Mm-hmm. We think of modern medicine. We think of medicine as being really modern. And yet, if you think about it, it's only about 300 years old. That's not very long. And there's still so much that we don't know about the human body and how it works. And we're at this turning point in history now where suddenly we can understand a lot more. So the more we are wired up, the more our information that can be pulled out of our bodies on how things work, it's only going to help us. I think that's how cancer is being solved and will be solved. But there's a host of diseases now that having all this information from large groups and being able to study people over time is going to be just a game changer.
It strikes me that it will be harder to lie in the future. I try not to lie to the doctor, but if I wanted to lie about how much exercise I was getting, the doctor might say, hand over that Fitbit. Let's look at the past month.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the flip side is that, knowledge is power. So if you, I sometimes wear a Fitbit and it will tell me how much I sleep or don't sleep. And I'll look at it sometimes and say, oh my God, I only slept 4 hours last night. And I may feel that, but somehow seeing the proof of it, changes everything.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a real belief that actually it will empower us as patients to be much more involved in our own healthcare by having the tools that we don't always have to go somewhere for a test or to the doctor. We'll have access to that information ourselves, and then we can go to doctors to share it. But we get much more. We're much greater participants in our own healthcare as a result of all the information that can be gleaned from the information that comes out of our bodies.
What about folks who are choosing, might choose not to avail themselves of those kinds of monitoring technologies? Will they be held culpable for their illnesses in a way that everybody who's, you know, willing to be monitored at all times will not be?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think the connected question is can any of us really check out anymore? We hear about the lack of privacy. The first thought is, I don't want to be tracked and I don't want all this information put out. But are we willing to not go on our computers, not use our phones, not do transactions online? I think very few of us are at a point now where we're willing to give up the world that we've stepped into. That in some ways we've opened Pandora's box and there isn't any going back. So I think it then becomes a question as a culture is how do we share it? What are the protections we put into place? I think one of the other things that's happening right now with the whole controversy over Apple being asked or ordered to unlock the phone was that if the NSA had not been secretly collecting so much data, then Apple and the other companies would not have felt forced to put in the encryptions that they put in. And so if we live in a society where trust is abused, then we're going to overreact. And I think that possibly had there been conversations between the government and the tech companies earlier on, then a solution could have been found. But now everyone's in a reactive mode. And that's not a good way to move forward as a society.
I'm so glad you brought that up because it's a perspective that I haven't heard expressed before. And it makes me think about, there's a section in the film talking about, you know, the potential to possibly predict, outbreaks of protest, you know, demonstration activity and that sort of thing. And then there's the question, you know, if the good guys can figure out that there's about to be something big taking place, maybe oppressive governments can do the same thing and quash those before they ever take hold.
So the technology is neutral. It's what we as humans choose to do with it.
Yeah.
I kept coming back to that constantly throughout the film because, you know, there is almost no system that can't be hacked, no matter how strong we make all the security. We live in a world where if someone really wants to do something destructive, chances are they'll find a way to do it. And that was true before technology came along. It's even more true now. So I think we still have to go back to our democratic systems to make sure that the people that we elect are looking out for the greater good and to do what we can to stop those people or those governments that are oppressing their people.
Is the promise of big data really accurate at the individual level, or is it more accurate in making predictions across large populations?
I think initially it's larger populations, but I think increasingly it's become individualized. There's a story in the film about a family where the mom had breast cancer and there had been a history of breast cancer in the family. And her 17-year-old daughter decided that she wanted to be tested because she wanted to know what the chances of her having the gene that would lead to having breast cancer. And with that knowledge, she can make decisions. If she found she didn't have the BRCA gene, then she could move forward with one way in her life. But if she had it, and I won't give it away here, but once she had the knowledge, it would change what she might possibly do in her life, preparing for the fact that she might have and come down with cancer.
How do we learn to ask the right questions of our data? Like, what is the mix between scientific and mathematical knowledge and just creativity in terms of applying data and combining different, you know, sets of facts?
That's a great question. One of the things that we came across, and this helped us in making the film, was, and I may get to your question in an oblique way, is that there's some really wonderful data artists who are working in this field. Aaron Koblin is one, Jared Thorpe is one. And these are scientists, they're data scientists, but they also found an immense amount of beauty in the data. And that helped them and helped us, I think all of us, sort of start to see the patterns and see the connections. And so in answer to your question, I think we never can lose our instinct as humans. And we will always be presented with a lot of information, and some of it will be fact and some of it will be more accurate than others. But I think we can't lose our basic humanity and our instincts of how to move through our lives. So there's a question we ask when we do the screening. If you could get a test and know what diseases you might come down with, would you like that information? And almost half the time, half the audience wants that information, and almost half the audience doesn't want the information. And I find that really fascinating. That split almost always happens 50-50. Some people want the knowledge so they can either prepare for it or find ways of preventing it. Other people just don't want to know.
I would totally want to know. Do you mind if I ask where you fall?
Yeah, I'm the same way with you. I was about to ask you that question. So I'm glad you told me.
Half the people would dare to ask, and half the people wouldn't, I guess.
That's right. No, I would want to know, because I think there are things you can do to prepare for it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Terry in Dallas. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Chris. This question is for Sandy, and it was from earlier in your broadcast about giving up privacy and data collection. And I wonder how accurate is the information they're gathering, because what comes to mind is several years ago, my mother, who's a whole generation older, had a fall and broke her pelvis. And I was Googling on Medline Plus and a few other places to get information. And for the longest time afterwards, I was getting pop-up ads about bone mineralization medications. And, you know, and I'm thinking, so if they're gathering information on me, then they're... aren't they going to conclude that people in my generation are having these problems when actually that wasn't the case at all?
Yep, no, that can happen, and that does happen a lot. You know, I was looking for a car a couple months ago, and for 4 months I kept getting the same ads for that car that I chose not to get. So clearly what you look for, what you search for, that is then fed into the big system and fed to advertisers who then pay money so they can direct ads back at you. A gentleman in the movie Joy Eater says that, you know, even if the personal data is taken away, if someone was looking, they could know exactly where you went every hour of the day, what you spent within about 4 feet, and be incredibly specific. And that information does exist and is there.
Surely people are trying to account in their profiles for those aberrations, right? Because everybody does it, right? You read about something and you just want to go look it up, but it doesn't necessarily affect you. And obviously, someone's trying to make the assessments of who we are and what we're doing sensitive enough to you know, weed those out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't quite know how they do it.
it's proprietary.
Because sometimes you get those responses immediately and those same ads follow you, and other times it has no consequence. So somehow the system and the algorithms that they've worked up are at play all the time, and then they're filtered to decide which ones to send you back that ad. There's a really incredible story, the Target story. There was a data scientist working for Target, and he wanted to see if they could predict certain things about who was pregnant by online searches. And so they actually went in and looked at women who had already signed up for the baby registry and looked at their shopping habits so they could kind of figure out what the patterns were. And a few weeks after this started, a manager in one of the stores got this call from this man, and he said, I'm not sure what you're doing, but you're sending all these ads to my 18-year-old daughter. It's almost like you're encouraging her to get pregnant for strollers and diapers and baby wipes. The manager, who knew nothing about this baby prediction monitor
system. He's trying to run the store.
He was trying to run the store. Felt really bad. And about 4 or 5 days later, he called the father back up again just to apologize. Father said, well, I actually talked to my daughter, and there are some things going on in my home I didn't know about. And in fact, she was pregnant. And that's how he found out. So that's pretty scary.
You know, what's interesting about that story is that, you know, one could imagine that if a woman is searching for things that are, you know, directly related to having a baby or, you know, taking care of a tiny baby, that makes sense. But there were some things on that list that sort of increased the chances that a woman was pregnant that are not so obvious, like unscented lotion and cotton balls. Yes, you use those for a baby, but you could use them for a variety of other things as well.
Well, part of it is that we're always not aware of our own psychology. Hmm. And one of the things that they're finding is that these systems can actually know more about us than we consciously know about ourselves. And that there are, you know, this notion of patterns, that we have patterns and we have patterns of behavior. And some of them we're aware of, but often we're very unconscious of. But the system is sometimes smarter than we are in our conscious behavior. And that story ends with Charles Duhigg, the reporter from the New York Times, saying that the gentleman who did this pregnancy predictor said, "Oh, this is just the beginning. We will know more about you than you know about yourself in a very short period of time." And that is a little bit chilling.
Did this process chip away at your belief, assuming you had it in free will?
You know, I came away with a couple of thoughts. One is I became actually a much greater believer in the benefits and the positive benefits of technology, that used well, used right, it is a tool that we need and will need increasingly as we live in a more complex world. But I also realized that the capacity for abuse is more powerful than ever, and it's critical that we become more vigilant as citizens in a democracy to make sure that those abuses don't happen and that the government or private companies are called to task when they abuse the system. And that, like it or not, we are intrinsically tied to our technology, and better that we control it and understand where it's going rather than just blindly follow it along.
Filmmaker Sandy Smolin is my guest. He directed the documentary The Human Face of Big Data, which airs tonight at 9 on KERA-TV. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Sandy Smolin about the new documentary he directed called The Human Face of Big Data. It airs tonight at 9 on KERA television. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Sandy, the term disaster mapping may not be familiar to people, but once you explain it, it makes perfect sense. Can you talk about what it is and how big data holds great promise?
Sure. So when there's a natural disaster, one of the things that people started to realize was that people were tweeting where things were happening, and that it's usually very hard to get information on the ground. And a group of data scientists out of Boston realized that if you could gather all those tweets, you could actually have real-time reporting of what was happening where. And so now it's turned into one of the most important tools in a disaster like the earthquake in Haiti. They were able to really identify where the tweets were coming from, get rescue workers and supplies where it was needed, and now it's used in almost every disaster, just by the phones that we all have. There's another connected story to that, which is Japan spent millions of dollars to put in an early warning earthquake system, and when there's an earthquake, it actually shuts down the trains and turns off power, and it's been very effective. But a group of scientists here realized that all of our computers have an accelerometer, which is turned to shut off if your computer falls off. The accelerometer shuts off, And then that could actually be its own early warning system. So people volunteer to let their computers, which we all have, be part of a network that costs no money at all to build because we all have the devices. And it's almost as efficient now as this billion-dollar system that the Japanese put in.
So there are a lot of vehicles on the road these days, but it seems like many of our traffic problems have to do with the fact that human beings are driving them. And we don't always follow the rules, and we have, you know, a lot of us need to go one direction sometimes and the other direction other times. How does big data, what promise does it hold for easing traffic congestion?
Well, I think that one of the reasons, you know, self-driving cars are becoming more and more frequent and more of a reality. And believe it or not, that's a data story. Those cars are being driven because they're crunching an immense amount of data and talking to each other. And part of the data story is connected to what's something called the Internet of Things, which is that all these devices, not only are they putting out data, but they're also talking to each other and sharing information, which is a pretty strange thought when you think about it, that you have billions of devices, and not only are they sensor devices, but they're communicating with each other and forming a picture of the world. So self-driving cars are basically taking all the data in from around them and looking at where traffic is, where other cars are, where pedestrians are, where objects are, and they're filtering all through that to a system that then allows those cars to be automated. And I think we're going to see that those cars be in use much faster than anyone ever predicted. It's happening at a pretty rapid rate. And it's a data story. It's another data story. I mean, everywhere we turned, in making the movie, we were kind of shocked that almost any story about technology could be turned into a data story.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Hey, I watched Charlie Rose interview Bill Gates last night, and a couple of points of interest that are relative here, I think. One, regarding the terrorist attack in San Bernardino and the suit between Apple and the FBI. Gates said, hands down, three times, so Charlie Rose said, you said that, which was, Apple has the key, or the can get in to, regardless of the algorithm they have that is unbreakable, but Gates was assured of that. The other is that he said in 40 years, less than 100 years, computers will be so powerful, they'll do so much of our work in addition to driving cars and sorting this, that, doing the dishes and such, it will raise a very serious question. And both of these, the terrorist attack in Apple FBI suit is a political decision, and also the power of computers will do so much that indeed they will take over and do much of our thinking, and it will raise a social and they implied also even a theological question as to purpose, human purpose.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Paul. A lot there. Sandy, is there anything that you wanted to pull out and comment on?
A lot. I'm trying to think where to start. I do believe that the pace of change is, and Bill is absolutely right, the pace of change is happening faster than we can imagine. I remember talking to, while we were doing the film back in 2014, data scientists would talk about the year 2009 like it was ancient history. And in their world, 5-6 years was a long time because things are changing so quickly. And so, yes, as a culture, I think we will need to think, it's really important to think in the future because the future is coming at us very fast. And a lot of the jobs that we've done in the past are going to disappear. And there's a real concern there's going to be a disconnect between the jobs that are needed, which will probably be in the tech field and be data scientists, and a lot of the more middle-class jobs will disappear. Clerks will disappear. Conductors. A lot of physical labor is going to be able to be totally mechanicalized and handled by computers. And so what are we as a society going to do about the kind of jobs that, that are left for us as humans. And I say that with a smile, but it's a real question. And I think that those questions need to be asked now, not when it happens and is sprung upon us in just a few years.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mohammed on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, this is Mohammed calling from Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, I'd just like to share a personal story. Like, I was doing some online research on cars, and all of a sudden, the Carvana ad popped up. I just looked there out of curiosity, and I bought the car. So I think this, like, online ad pop up out of your search is pretty cool. And
so let me get this straight, Mohammed. You started searching for cars, and then you got an ad for a particular car, and it was the one you wanted, and you bought that car.
No, the ad popped up for a company. It's like an online car selling company.
Uh-huh.
And I just looked there out of curiosity, and I loved their model and everything, and it's kind of like Amazon, Carvana. So I just liked the car, I bought it, and they just delivered it in front of my house. So what I'm trying to say is, like, data collection in terms of search is pretty good, and the companies which are adopting right now, they're doing a pretty good job, and probably in future it will even get better.
Thanks so much for your call. You know, Sandy, Mohammed points out the fact that there's a lot that works really well for us. It's so well that we hardly even notice it unless something really remarkable happens.
Yep, no, absolutely. And we're going to get used to those things. You know, as you mentioned, Amazon, and, you know, they're now, they went from 2-day free delivery to now 1 day to now 4 hours in cities like Seattle and San Francisco, where you can order something and they'll have it to you within 3 or 4 hours. And we'll begin to think that's the norm, and we'll want that. That's because the devices are in place, and it's they're reflecting what people want. They're taking the lead, but also it's successful because people are responding to it.
It is interesting to consider what companies that are inclined to sell us something have learned about our behavior, because even though on the one hand it seems rather frivolous, they have a vested interest in understanding their customers very, very well.
Indeed. I mean, I love the story that gentleman just told. The ad popped up. He bought the car and it was delivered right there. You know, that's the system, the way they want it to work.
Right.
And there's the convenience. That's the trade that we're going to make, because it's convenient. And again, we don't always know ourselves, but the system may know us better than we know. So in that case, they figured out what he wanted and they delivered it in every sense of the word.
You report on efforts to understand why certain geographic areas seem to generate more crime than others. And the idea is that if communities could take the money they would spend on incarcerating people within, you know, a certain number of blocks and invest it in the community before people break the law, you might actually keep people from breaking the law. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Sometimes when you look at the data, it tells you something that you know instinctively, or you know intuitively, but you've never had proof of. And so there was a study done in neighbors in Brooklyn, and they found that this state was spending $1 million a year on certain blocks keeping people in prison, and they'd be released and they'd go back to prison. And when you saw the amount of money that was spent in a very small, concentrated area, the question then got raised was, is this the best use of our money as a society, just incarcerating people? Maybe there's another way to address the problem. And so the data, when they looked at it and when they mapped it, showed what people on the ground knew instinctively, but they could never prove it, or they could never really go. Armed with that information, then they had the ability to go and say, look, this much money is being spent, and it's really not being spent well. There has to be a better way.
What's great about that example is that it's so much more positive than the thing that, you know, I think there have been dystopian stories about this sort of thing. You know, you could take a bunch of data and try to predict who was going to commit a crime and somehow, you know, incarcerate them or further prevent them from acting freely to keep them from bad actions.
Right, right. And that's where we all tend to initially go when we talk about data not being used well. But But as you said, they flipped it around and they said, look, there's a solution here and there's a better way to solve the problem here rather than just putting people in this cycle of in prison, back into the neighborhood, back to prison again.
When we worry about the effects of things like big data, do you think, Sandy, that it's the technology that we don't trust, or somehow do we not trust ourselves as the people who invent it? Do we have this sense that we cannot, you know, possibly control this thing that we've created?
I'm not sure we're quite there yet. I think that may be a question that comes down the road, but I think right now it's really about who's using it, how it's being used by us as humans. And I love that, you know, it's a great question that you asked, because our goal in the movie was to talk about the human impact on this. And that goes both ways, both the impact on us as users of the technology, but also those of us who are in control of it. And I think there is a moral imperative to make the right choices and to try to use it wisely and to try to make sure that the right controls are in place. And we live in a wonderful country where we can affect those decisions and make those decisions and make sure our leaders make the right decisions. And so if there's one takeaway from the film, it's like we all are part of this. We're not just bystanders. We're not just observers. This is our world. And this is happening to us. And we can either let it happen to us, or we can be involved in making sure that it happens in the right way.
What happens to people who are still at the wrong end of the digital divide, which is not only lower income people and not exclusively them, but a lot of older folks or people with, you know, disabilities that might make it hard for them to engage?
You know, there's a lot of movement to make sure that the internet and digital devices now reach the world. I just got a Facebook request from a young girl that I met in Nepal when I was doing a film there about 4 years ago. And she lived in a village with no running water, no electricity. And I just got a Facebook request from her. And she looks like she could be in Beverly Hills. And the great part of that is now she is now online. She can be part of the conversation. She can get access to education in a way that was not possible 4, 5, 6 years ago. And that's happening all over the world. So I think that's a remarkable, there's still a lot of people who aren't on, but there are so many more people that never would have been on before that are on now. And that makes a much more connected world and bringing a lot of people into the 21st century that never would have been before.
And it goes both ways, right? I mean, you can understand her life in Nepal better than you could before you had connected.
Absolutely. It creates empathy, and it creates, you know, I think as a planet, we'll do better when we're all connected and that we can connect with each other through different ways. And in some ways, country boundaries may disappear or may not be quite as strong as they used to be because people are talking in a way across cultures, across economic groups, across country lines in a way that just wasn't simply possible before.
Filmmaker Sandy Smolin directed the new documentary, The Human Face of Big Data. It's airing tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA television. Sandy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day. We'll